Welcome to the Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour on KPFK Radio, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, and streaming on the web for the world at www.kpfk.org. My name is Tammy Banglu. I'm here with my co-host, Manuel Criollo. We'll start the show today with Clayton Thomas Mueller of the Indigenous Environmental Network, who just came back from the UN Climate Change Conference in Montreal, where over 180 nations met to discuss the implementation of the Kyoto Protocols and to begin discussion on what would happen when Kyoto expires in 2012. As we speak, thousands of people from around the world are gathered in Hong Kong protesting the World Trade Organization ministerial meeting. We'll have first-hand reports from Los Angeles and New York City-based organizers who are part of a four-city delegation in Hong Kong participating in the actions. We'll also have Vijay Prashad on what's up for grabs inside the governmental negotiations. Then we'll have Elena Pop, a housing rights lawyer representing the tenants of Lincoln Place Apartments in Venice, who were recently evicted in one of the largest mass evictions in the history of Los Angeles Housing Department. She'll be joined with one of the evictees, Julia Bernard. And finally, several hours ago, Schwarzenegger denied clemency to Stanley Tookie Williams, founder of the Crips Gang and the Nobel Peace Prize nominee. He's scheduled to be executed at 12:01 Tuesday. Reading some paragraphs out of the full text of Schwarzenegger's denial, it stated where Schwarzenegger wrote, "The dedication of Williams' book, Life in Prison, cast significant doubts on his personal redemption. This book was published in 1998, several years after Williams claimed redemptive experience. Specifically, this book is dedicated to, quote, Nelson Mandela, Angela Davis, Malcolm X, Assata Shakur, Geronimo Pratt, Ramona Africa, John Africa, Leonard Peltier, George Jackson, Mumia Abdul-Jamal, and countless other men and women and youth who have endured the hellish suppressions of being behind bars," unquote. It goes on to say, "The mix of individuals on this list is curious. Most have violent pasts and some have been convicted of heinous murders, including the killing of law enforcement. But the inclusion of George Jackson on this list defies reason and is a significant indicator that Williams is not reformed and he still sees violence and lawlessness as a legitimate means to address societal problems," end quote. So this was taken out of the full text of Schwarzenegger's denial for clemency of Tookie Williams. We're urging everyone to join the protest visuals. The one in L.A. is at 6 p.m. in front of the Westwood Federal Building. So go to www.savetookiewilliam.org. We'll have more on this at the end of the show. Stay tuned, and we'll be back with our first guest, Clayton Thomas Mueller. Welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines. From December 3rd to 9th, over 180 nations attended the UN Climate Change Conference to discuss the progress and future of the Kyoto Protocols. Not surprisingly, the U.S. played a hostile role in its continued attempt to undermine efforts at restricting greenhouse gas emissions. Many environmental justice organizations, such as the Indigenous Environmental Network, attended the conference, challenging the U.S. and other industrialized nations to go beyond Kyoto, that only mandates a 5% reduction of greenhouse gases. Joining us is Clayton Thomas Mueller, an oil campaign organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network, who just returned from Montreal. Welcome, Clayton. It's good to have you on the show.
Hey, hello, everybody. It's good to be here, and hello to all the listeners.
So why don't we start? I mean, in 1998, the United States had actually pushed forward the Kyoto Protocols and was the one that was advocating for a 5% reduction when some of the numbers were citing 12%, et cetera. But the last reports say, as of Saturday, they walked out on the negotiations. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, to quote our director, Tom Goldtooth, directly in a recent article in the Montreal Gazette, giving reference to the visit of former U.S. President Bill Clinton, who actually spoke at the Commission on Climate Change 11 in Montreal. He said, "We're very embarrassed by our leadership here in the United States. The walkout of the U.S. delegation from the meeting on Thursday on future reduction commitments is a slap in the face for all Americans concerned about climate change. And bottom line, you know, grassroots people need to rise up and demand accountability from the State Department and from the from President Bush on this matter, because it's just ridiculous, the lack of commitment or the blatant disregard for the human rights implications of failure to act accordingly on this huge problem of climate change that we're currently facing.
So, I mean, it's been the same. What were the main reasons that the U.S. walked out? Is it what it's citing is that they don't want any legal binding commitments. So they're asking for what, voluntary measures?
Well, what it comes down to is the United States has been leading the charge at this COP and former COPs on basically trying to erode any movement forward in terms of the creation of international, you know, multilateral environmental law that'll force countries to have, you know, emissions reductions that'll actually do something to mitigate, you know, global warming. The United States government, the Bush administration, I mean, I will say flat out, is in the back pockets of transnational oil and gas corporations, which view, you know, legally binding emissions reductions commitments as an economic challenge, I guess, to their ability to operate as business as usual. In other words, if there are legally binding constraints put on the United States' business as usual operations, the government is basically trying to argue that that's going to hurt our capitalist imperialist system. But the reality of it is, you know, we're spiraling down an environmental catastrophe here, where if we don't do something about it now, we're going to see a lot more situations like what just unfolded in the Gulf Coast with Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita. And it sure as heck ain't going to be President Bush's family that's going to be staying at the Superdome. It's going to be low-income communities of color, indigenous communities, and other, you know, disadvantaged populations. Economically speaking.
Hey, Clinton, this is Manuel Criollo, the other host here in Voices from the Frontlines. Can you talk to us a little bit about what the fight looked like and how was the United Front against, essentially, or not against, but mainly trying to force the U.S. to sign on this? What were the different debates in it? I mean, I know that there's a big debate around the issues around carbon trading,
yes,
even within the United Front of that wants to force the U.S. to sign this agreement.
Well, you know, it was an interesting conference. I mean, this was the largest COP ever. We had 8,000 to 10,000 delegates. You know, there were representatives from the entire NGO community, including an incredibly strong presence of NGOs representing the building of the inclusive movement for climate justice. The climate change debate is a pretty serious one due to the fact that, you know, a couple of COPs ago, the only NGO group that has a recognized mechanism to participate and provide interventions or into the COP is the U.S. Or the International Climate Action Network, which is a coalition of, you know, environmental groups, conservation groups, and all the big heavy hitters like World Wildlife Fund, Greenpeace, you know, the list goes on and on. The problem is that they sold out kind of into you know, buying into this whole market-based strategy, which is, you know, things like pollution trading, you know, the promotion of sinks as an actual of carbon sinks as a way to mitigate climate change, and basically approaching this global problem by putting faith into the market that caused the problem in the first place to solve it. The Indigenous Environmental Network, along with other organizations such as the Durban Group, as well as the Environmental Justice Climate Change Initiative, were at this Commission on Climate Change, bringing frontline community activists, communities from places like the Gulf Coast, from places like the North Slope of Alaska that are disproportionately impacted by climate change, to shed some light on this critical debate that's happening in the international climate talks. The fact that, you know, there are major, major human rights implications to carbon defense mechanisms and these lucrative markets that are being built up right now. We're talking about a $1 trillion market here that's being built up right now under the Kyoto trading regime. And the problem is that, yet again, there are systems of oppression built right into there in terms of classism, in terms of racism, and all kinds of situations that we're trying to make sure that people are aware of. And this is why, you know, our organization, as well as others, brought grassroots communities of color, leaders from communities of color, leaders from indigenous communities, to talk about the fact that many of these solutions that countries are propping up are actually going to accelerate or compound the on-the-ground impacts that our communities face. Because, you know, in situations where countries of the North are able to purchase credits from countries of the South to actually emit more CO2s and more pollutions up here, well, which communities are beside the oil refineries, are beside the coal-fired power plants, are beside the places where they're extracting oil and gas? Well, it's communities of color and indigenous communities. And so, you know, what we argue is that, you know, these things need to be taken into consideration in these international climate debates. And again, in the global South, where they're displacing indigenous farmers and campesino farmers from fertile agricultural land so that they can plant monocrop eucalyptus tree plantations with some hope to catch carbon emissions out of Mother Earth's atmosphere, well, this is just not a solution, in our opinion, to mitigating climate change. The other thing that we were, you know, that listeners need to be aware of in terms of the international debate on climate change is the fact that, you know, in the talks around adaptation, in other words, how are we going to adapt to the more violent, unpredictable weather that is associated with, you know, with the greenhouse effect, aka global warming, is that, you know, one of the things we were trying to do is to ensure that there was indigenous participation and indigenous experts that carry that indigenous traditional ecological knowledge to participate in the United Nations official list of experts to develop those adaptation programs, you know, so that, again, those most disproportionately impacted by climate change would be making, you know, some contribution in terms of how we on Mother Earth are going to deal with this global situation. So it's a very complex debate that's happening. You know, that's created a lot of division and a lot of divide. However, one of the really empowering things at this conference is that the Durban Group, the Environmental Justice Climate Change Initiative, the Indigenous Environmental Network, Sierra Youth Coalition, and others all contributed together to actually have an alternative people's forum, which was a space designed for this discussion to actually take place, because, this, of course, there was not space provided for this dialogue within the actual UN Conference on Climate Change. Members of the parties won.
Can you talk thanks for that, Clayton. So Kyoto is a 5% reduction based on 1990 standards.
Yeah.
But can you talk about the demands that are coming out of countries like Tuvalu and the Indigenous Environmental Networks, where they're calling for a 50, 60% reduction?
Well, you know, I mean, scientists, the IPCC, the, you know, scientists around the world have basically, you know, have hard data, have hard scientific, Western scientific data now that tells us that, you know, the world's CO2, atmospheric CO2 levels, okay, in other words, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has never been this high. And, you know, and we have data now that goes back 700,000 years. And so basically, you know, small island states like the country of Tuvalu, what indigenous communities and, you know, other activists are trying to push forward is a much, much stronger emissions reductions commitment from industrialized countries of the North, and we are calling for a 60 to 80% reduction, you know, with it, but, you know, now, bottom line, because of, like I said, the catastrophic human rights implications of failure to adequately act on this matter. But of course, again, you know, we're going up against the multi-billion-dollar oil and gas industry, the lobbyists that are, you know, of course, cloaking themselves, you know, with the U.S. State Department and the rest of their gang of climate gangsters, I guess you could call them, trying to stall any kind of real commitments. And we've seen that happen here at the Commission on Climate Change 11. You know, there was no leadership taken by the United States of America. I mean, even former President Bill Clinton, even in his own diplomatic kind of, you know, democratic way, you know, slammed the United States by saying that, you know, the only kind of preemptive policies that this country should have is a preemptive policy to strike now against climate change. And failure to do so is just absolutely insane.
We're speaking to Clayton Mueller from the Indigenous Environmental Network. Excuse me, Clayton. You came to our conference in February where we talked about at least our campaign here in Los Angeles, which is trying to force local agencies, if the Bush administration decides not to sign Kyoto, what we can do here in Los Angeles to reduce auto emission by reducing the number of cars and expanding public transportation, where we think we can go beyond Kyoto in that sense of not just looking at a 5% reduction, but how do we really address the climate question here in the world. Can you talk to us about the work that you guys are doing in relationship to alternative fuels, in relationship to even just a different base, a model that doesn't base itself on the petrochemical industry?
Well, again, you know, we had a pretty incredible delegation of indigenous leaders from Canada, Alaska, and the lower 48 states. And part of that delegation was Pat Spears and Bob Goff of the ICOOP organization, which is a native organization that is promoting wind power development in the Dakotas. in North and South Dakota, it has been calculated, you know, with all kinds of tests and scientific processes and whatnot, that it is actually the Saudi Arabia of wind power for Mother Earth. Nowhere else on the planet is there an area more conducive for the development of wind power technologies. And the Intertribal Utilities Commission, or AKA ICOOP, headed up by Pat Spears and Bob Goff, has been, you know, trying to promote this knowledge around, you know, to try and fight against unsustainable energy development that has been taking place in Indian country. You see, something most people don't realize is that 35% of all of the fossil fuels in the United States of America are located on or directly near indigenous lands. And this sets up a serious situation because of the fact that, you know, with our nation so incredibly addicted to fossil fuels, our communities are disproportionately impacted for unsustainable energy development, you know, coal mining, oil and gas extraction, the list goes on and on. And, of course, our communities end up becoming batteries for unsustainably designed cities like Los Angeles, like Phoenix, the list goes on and on. So, you know, of course, one of our big messages at the Commission on Climate Change was that there is a lot of indigenous peoples, indigenous leadership that are not against development, but we want it done in the right way. And that's why we had ICOOP join us. And we also had Lynn Jacobs of the host community of the Commission on Climate Change, the Mohawk community of Ganawagi, which is about 20 minutes outside the city of Montreal. And, you know, they're developing their housing program, which basically their houses are completely off the grid. Their new homes that they're proposing to build in their nation are totally based on renewable energy. They'll deal with passive solar design, geothermal heat. And they're really quite incredible. And so part of our whole strategy at the Commission on Climate Change was to highlight, you know, the leadership that is taking place in Indian country on making the transition away from the fossil fuel economy to a renewable, low-carbon intensive economy.
Well, thank you so much, Clayton Thomas Mueller with the Indigenous Environmental Network. In the last 30 seconds, Clayton, can you give us information for our listeners for IEN and some of your projects?
Yeah, I mean, you know, definitely come to our website. Check out www.ienearth.com.
Mm-hmm.
And for information on our energy campaign and our campaign for climate justice, you can check out the links on the right-hand side of the page. And I also want to encourage you to go to the Durban Group's Climate Justice blog, which has information about all of the things we're talking about here on this radio show. If you Google Climate Justice blog, it'll come up. Go check it out.
Again, that was www.ienearth.org. Thanks so much, Clayton.
Thank you so much.